The 1996 Sun Symposium presents session number 164. Is it gossip or storytelling? A panel including Deborah Rossiter, Susan J. Krupa, and Cricket Goodsell-Willardson. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be blank.
I'd like to welcome you to our panel, Is It Gossip or Storytelling? This panel is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum, and we would like to invite any of you who would like to get involved in the Mormon Women's Forum to talk to, or would like more information on the forum, to talk to one of us with the pink dots on our name tags. Or talk to somebody at the Mormon Women's Forum table, which is located down the hall this way and around the corner. Also, we will be holding our fourth annual Counterpoint Conference on November 9th, 1996 at Utah Valley State College in Orem, Utah, and we'd like to invite all of you to attend. So often, women's discourse has been labeled as gossip. But what is gossip? Some people define it as talking about other people, period. This has always been a troubling definition for me, because if you can't talk about people, what else is there to talk about? As I sat in my mother's kitchen listening to her and her friends talk about the latest pregnancy or divorce, I was enthralled. These stories taught me about life. They taught me about human nature. Sometimes I think the reason women's discourse has sneeringly been called gossip is that it so often strips away our masks. It reveals those dark secrets which show that things are never what they seem. Our panel this morning is made up of a diverse group of women who deal with stories in different ways. Susan Krupa is a fantasy and science fiction writer. Her stories are rich with meaning and paradox as she explores religious and ethical issues. Her short story, The Healer, was important in my own life as I struggled with many of the issues she addresses in it. Cricket Goodsell-Willardson has an MA in English with an emphasis in feminist literary theory. Currently, she is a technical writer at the Ameritech Corporation in Provo, Utah. I'm Deborah Rossiter, and I'm the third participant. I have been majoring in English at BYU for an eternity. I am also a fiction writer who loves to write and to read stories. Recently, I've noticed that the theme of storytelling figures prominently in many contemporary novels, especially those written by women. And I will talk about this and about women's discourse in general. Thank you.
My topic doesn't have much to do with, although it, I hope, has something to do with storytelling, but I was asked to speak about storytelling from the perspective of a writer, and also asked to perhaps read some excerpts from one of my stories. That's something no writer can resist, so here I am. I'm going to start out with a true story. In 1989, I received a letter from a longtime friend. "I'm afraid I have bad news," she wrote. "I found out in February that I have breast cancer, and it wasn't detected early. But the doctor thinks that with a good attitude and hard work, I can get through this." I was stunned, but I shared her hopes for a full recovery. We wrote several times that year. Then in the summer of 1990, I received a card from her. "There is no easy way to tell you that the cancer is widespread. The good news is that the doctors have stopped all treatments. My hospice nurse tells me that I am suffering less from the cancer than I did with the treatments. Spiritually, we have been blessed. All our prayers have been answered, and I was told not to worry about my children. They would be fine. And I have found peace because of my beliefs." "Please don't be too sad," she wrote. "In spite of everything, I know that Heavenly Father is taking good care of me." This time, I was not only stunned, but angry, furious at God for doing this to her. I remember sitting in the car at the post office after I read her card, crying, unable to even pray because I was so angry at God. How could she say, and I was angry at my friend too, how could she say God was taking care of her when in fact he was allowing her to die a very painful death? How could he do this to her? How could she so cheerfully accept this? I planned a visit to Utah in August to see her. I was living in Arizona at the time. When I wrote to her to check on the date, she answered, "Any time is fine. There are never any guarantees anymore, but I think the 14th or 15th would be soon enough." So I made my trip to Utah, still unable to pray because of my anger, and I arranged to visit my friend. That visit changed my life in ways that I can't explain, except to say that the moment I walked through the door into her house, I felt a spirit of peace and calm that was so palpable, it was as if I had walked into some place that had a different air pressure or gravity. My anger evaporated. It could not be sustained in this atmosphere. And my friend and I had a wonderful visit. We had a 4 or 5 hour visit, which her husband told me later was the longest that she had had for several months before or that she had to her death. She had had several experiences or visions in her life in the next world that had filled her with joy and even eagerness to be there. I didn't understand her eagerness, but my anger was gone. She died several months later. I've told you about my friend because I want to talk about how I translate real life events or real stories into fictional ones that I hope not only carry a reality of their own, but tell a bigger story, perhaps that transcends my personal one. Every writer is different, but for me, the translation is not literal. In other words, while much of what I write is autobiographical in an emotional or psychological sense, it rarely is in terms of setting or characters or events in the story. My friend's death gave me an idea for a story. I wanted to write about the helplessness I felt when I first heard about the cancer. I wanted to write about the anger I felt towards God and the miraculous way it had vanished, and about how hard it is to understand what God wants from our own perspective. In thinking about it, I decided to write about a healer who could heal everyone except the person she loved the most. As I said, my translations are not literal. I didn't want to write about my friend and myself in a contemporary setting. I had been doing a lot of research into Hopi culture because I planned to write a historical novel with that setting, and I have to say that 6 years later, I'm finally finishing that novel. So I set the story on the Hopi Mesas some 40 years after a devastating world war has decimated the world's population. And there's a small group of Indians from different tribes that have banded together on these mesas to survive. In the story, although the years just after the war were brutal and most people died, now the survivors have enough to eat and are as comfortable as they can be without the technological comforts that we enjoy today. The story opens when Nahu Tiwa, a 50-year-old healer, is asked to help at a birthing. He discovers at the birthing that the mother is pregnant with twins, and this terrifies him because he has been plagued with nightmares about twins who devour him. He doesn't want to birth these babies, but he is forced to because he needs the trust of the people. All the old ceremonies have been lost due to the drastic reduction in population, and Nahu Tiwa has spent his life trying to restore them. I'm going to read from the story, The Healer. He had the power to heal her. The warmth of the crystal told him that. More power than their fathers or grandfathers ever had. For in the days of the white man, the power had withered like an uprooted weed in the summer sun. Didn't they know that? But he had searched it out bit by bit, learning from anyone of any tribe willing to teach, begging the wise men, groveling for knowledge like a dog begging scraps, finding what had been lost, discovering what had been hidden. All he wanted, all he could ever remember wanting, was to restore these ceremonies to his people. But to do that, he needed a different kind of power, the power that came from the villagers' belief in him, from their trust. This healing could give him that power. So Nahu Tiwa uses his power, his healing power that he has, to help at the birthing, and instead of twins, a single baby is born, a single girl. And he's relieved because he thinks, after all, how much threat can a girl be? In the next scene, the baby is now a little girl, and we learn that while her mother died at birth, I'm sorry, it's nice getting old, you can't see anything. While her mother died at birth, the girl, Movi, is cared for her by her grandmother, Nan. Grandmother, tell me again how I got my name, said Movi. She was snuggled down deep against the soft expanse of Nan's bosom, and her face bounced with a rumble of laughter that came from her request. Again? Asked Nan. Always you want the same story. Movi felt the vibrations of Nan's voice soft and low as the story began of her mother's death, of Nan's great love for her, even though Nan always added Movi was fussy and stubborn as an infant, and occasionally even now. As Nan talked, Movi ran her hand across Nan's neck, cracked and lined like a dry bed of clay, but somehow soft. Nan's arms, smelling faintly of wood smoke and corn dust, were wrapped around her, shielding her like the shucks round a growing ear of corn or the cocoon round a caterpillar. Now the real story is set to begin. Movi, when she's 8, discovers that she has the power to heal people. Through an accident that is partly her fault, a boy named Johnny falls off the cliff off the mesa's edge. If you've ever lived out in Hopi, you understand they all live up on top of these mesas, and the drop can be fairly dramatic if a child or steps too far or goes off to the edge. When Moby gets to Johnny, he is unconscious and twisted in a position that can only mean death. She is in despair when she sees him. She stood and looked towards the trail, wishing for help, but dreading the explanations that would have to be made. And then a voice behind her said, "Crush me." Moby whirled around, but no one was there. She turned back to Johnny, watching him closely. Could he have crushed me? Johnny hadn't moved, hadn't spoken, she was certain. She turned again, heart pounding, and slowly looked in all four directions. Nothing. "Crush me against the rock with your hands." Then, on top of a boulder the height of her knees, she saw a wolf spider as big as and black as a tarantula, but smoother and more delicately built. "Crush me and heal the boy," it said. "I don't understand," said Moby. The spider didn't answer. "Help me," Moby cried. "I don't understand." She thought of her hand against the flesh of the spider and shuddered. As if it read her mind, the spider began moving away from her. Johnny was dying, and it was her fault, and the spider was just walking away. "Help me," she screamed at it, her anger rising black as the spider. She bent over and thrust her hand against it, feeling the crunch as its body gave way beneath her weight. She stood there shaking, staring at the dark stain on her hand, then pushed her other hand against the pulp on the rock. "Crush me and heal the boy," it had said. She knelt beside Johnny, her hands black with the spider's lifeblood, and laid them on his head. "Heal." It was a command, a plea, a yearning, a prayer. The blood cleared from Johnny's nose and mouth. Moby moved her hands to his neck, still skewed at an impossible angle. "Heal," she whispered. And Johnny's neck straightened. Slowly she worked her way down, touching every part of his broken body with her own hands bloodied from the spider's broken body. Moby heals him, but her new power, the power to heal whenever a spider is sent, isolates her from the other villagers who are afraid of her. She loses her best friend, and people won't talk to her. And it outrages Nahutiwak. He has worked his whole life to learn how to heal with this crystal, and now he sees an 8-year-old girl who does it without anything. So Moby is alone, and she depends even more on her grandmother Nan. Then Nan gets sick. Moby desperately wants to heal her, but a spider never appears in Nan's presence. Moby asks Nan where the power to heal comes from, and her grandmother answers that maybe it comes from Spider Grandmother. So Moby goes to the cave that is supposed to be Spider Grandmother's and leaves offerings daily, but still no spider is sent to heal Nan. While in the cave, she discovers that thousands of spiders live there, but in all the thousands of spiders in the cave, she still doesn't see one wolf spider. Then one day, she discovers a lump on Nan's neck, and she knows that her grandmother has cancer. It was death she was looking at, death growing on Nan's neck, hiding like a coward under her skin. And now Moby knew what was devouring Nan, eating the life from her. Nan turned, and her smile faded, her eyes filled with pity. "So you've seen it," she said at last. "I'll heal you," said Moby. "It'll go away. You're better today." Nan shook her head. "I'm not better, Moby. I'm happier. Because I know I had a dream, Moby. I saw Spider Grandmother. She told me to get ready, that my journey to the underground was soon." "No!" She hadn't meant to shout, but that's how it came out. Was Nan just going to give up? Nan, who fought for everything, who was the only one in the village with the courage to stand up to Nahutiwa? Was she just going to lie down on her mat and die? Nan reached out to Moby and drew her close, holding her tight, rocking her slightly as she used to do when Moby was a small child. Only now the strong brown arms were trembling sticks, and the breath fell. "I dreamt of the underworld," said Nan, and the joy crept back into her voice. "Spider Grandmother was there. My mother and your mother, Elsie, were there, and I remembered all the old stories." Moby pushed free of Nan's arms. "I'll heal you. I'll heal you, or I'll never heal again." "Don't say that," said Nan, the old fire flashing in her eyes. "How can you say that? You've been watching for a spider ever since I got sick. And have you seen one?" "No, because I am to make this journey." Had she seen one, though her eyes searched the stone floor, searched every crack in the stone walls, searched until they ached from the searching, suddenly the room was suffocating her. There was no air left to breathe. She ran out the door and then down the trail that wound down the mesa, ran in a furious, mindless descent. Her breath came now in ragged gasps, but she didn't stop until she reached Spider Grandmother's cave. No more sitting in silence. No more begging. She dove into the entrance of the cave and scraped across the rocks, heedless of the flesh she was leaving behind. "I hate you," she whispered first, then screamed, pounding her hands into the webs on the rocks, smashing the spiders. She would kill them as Spider Grandmother was killing Nan. She beat her hands against the rocks, ignoring the blood that ran down her arms, ignoring the stab in her heart as each spider died. She would search them out just as she had searched for a wolf spider in vain, and she would crush them all. Her hands throbbed from the beating. Still, she slammed them against the bodies of the spiders. "I hate you," she screamed, and suddenly realized it was Nan's face she was seeing. Nan, she was pummeling with her bloody hands. And the horror of it was a knife cutting her in two, but she couldn't stop. She killed spider after spider, pounding the rocks again and again and again. How could Nan leave her? Did the cocoon dissolve before the butterfly was formed? Did the shucks fall off before the ear was ripe? Finally, she dropped face down on the ground, too tired to move. How long she lay there, she couldn't tell, but suddenly she felt a movement of air. Turning on her back, she gasped. The cave had vanished, and she stared at stars in the night sky. And even as she watched, a part of the sky began to glow, and it intensified and took the shape of a woman, tall and graceful, wearing the gathered skirt and blue velveteen shirt of the Navajos. Her hair swept back gracefully into a bun. Her mouth was tender, and compassion flowed like rivers from her mouth. She extended an arm, and from it floated a thread that fell with silken grace from the sky. A mountain sprang up from where the thread touched the earth. Another thread covered the mountain with trees. Another brought bluebirds, sparrows, and hawks to inhabit the trees. Moby watched as the woman sent thread after thread until the earth was a jumble of threads, a web so intricate that only its maker, connected to it in every way, could comprehend it. Then the woman reached down, and from the maze of threads netted about her, she pulled a single one. Hand over hand on the silver thread, she pulled it to her. At the other end was Nan. And as Nan, drawn by the silver strand, lifted from the earth and began to cross the gulf of sky between her and the woman, Moby saw that another thread extended from Nan to the earth. She strained to see where it led. Then, in astonishment, found it coming from her own heart, a thread of silver sticky to the touch. And then she saw that there were many threads connected to her sparkling in the starlight, but two shone the brightest, the one to the woman and the one to Nan. "It is Spider Grandmother," thought Moby, and she watched as Nan completed her journey across the sky and into Spider Grandmother's embrace. Moby's thread to Nan was still intact. Moby felt the warmth pulsing through it, and when she touched her fingers to it, she smelled wood smoke and corn dust. Well, the story doesn't end there. There's much more to it than what I've summarized here. In fact, I've only told you half the story. I have given you what I translated from the real-life account of my friend's cancer and my reaction to it to this story. But there's a whole second story that is developed by Nahutiwa, who started out as a villain but grew more sympathetic the more I wrote and revised, until his issues became as important to the story as Moby's, perhaps even more important. This is one of the wonderful things about writing. You start out to write one thing, you start out on a journey, and you're constantly surprised by the new roads that crop up and the strange places they take you. As a writer, if a story is to transcend your personal life, you have to allow it to grow. You have to treat your characters as you would children. You can't let them run willy-nilly without any discipline at all, because they'll destroy the place, and your story won't have any structure. But if you are too authoritarian, if you stifle them, your characters, so that they can't speak for themselves, they become stiff and one-dimensional. If I had made Nahutiwa the bad guy I originally intended him to be, the story would have lost a critical dimension, and it would have just been another tale of grief. Before my friend's death, during the last visit we had together, at one point, talking about her cancer and her future, she gave a somewhat rueful laugh and said, "This story doesn't have a happy ending." But I don't think she really meant it, because like Nan, she had seen a vision of the other world and was ready to move on. At any rate, I made my story have an ending that, while painful, was at least optimistic. My friend is now in God's hand, and I trust that he is much better at bringing about happy endings than I ever will be. Thank you.
Many years ago, believe it or not, can you hear me? Many years ago, believe it or not, I wrote a thesis, and it was about the way women read and discuss literature. What I originally had wanted to do when I began this thesis was to do it on The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. Some of you may have read it. For those of you who haven't, I'm going to take maybe 1 minute and just give you what you need to know for the rest of this, my presentation, to make any sense. The Handmaid's Tale is about, it's a futuristic tale about a big change in society where women are divided into very specific roles. Some women are breeders, some women are mothers, and so forth. And they're identified by certain colors of cloaks that they wear. The handmaid, being the breeder, would be wear red and so forth. Now, The Handmaid's Tale is really just one of the handmaid's journal. And it tells about some of her experiences and her thoughts and feelings, her memory of the society that she remembers, the one that we currently live in. And she always addresses the reader with you. And that drew me in quite a bit, as you can imagine, you always does. But it doesn't end with her story. Her story doesn't even end, really. You don't know what happens to her. There's no sense of resolution of her life. The way the story ends is that some years after The Handmaid's Tale has been written or whatever it was, a set of historians have found this tale, and they're now analyzing it, and they're doing a symposium on it, kind of like this maybe. And their symposium, they analyze it. They're trying to understand, or really they're trying to prove her existence. They're trying to prove what happened in that society and why women were treated this way. And the historians finally come to the conclusion that she probably existed, but it's really not that important. This devastated me when I read that. And I wanted to write my thesis on that devastation, but I didn't know how to express it. As I was thinking about all of this, I happened to call my dad for something, and he told me a very interesting story about my mother and her own master's thesis many, many years ago. In her thesis defense, the committee of three people, two men and one woman, she got through with her defense, and they looked at her and said, "You know, this is not going to do. This paper and your defense will not do. People at our university do not write like this. This reads like something you'd find in Ladies' Home Journal or Cosmopolitan." So she had to redo it. So that struck me. I thought, oh, what am I going to do? You know, here I wanted to talk about my own personal experience with The Handmaid's Tale, and yet there didn't seem to be a language for me to write about it. The language that was available for me, the academic scholarly language, was very detached. There was no room for the self, no room for my experiences. The norms, that norm of academic language, and give me a moment here to explain this when I say this, the norms for me were really based on male critical theory. Now let me explain male, because I don't want to offend anybody. Okay? Male critical theory is a concept of literary theory and interpretation and creativity and ultimately of reality that's based almost entirely on men's experience, male experience, and then put forward as universal. But it isn't neutral. It's not objective. It is a human construct. It sounds objective because it seems to be like a discourse between it and it. It's as if people are referring to themselves in the third person, like Stalin or Bob Dole. But it's not objective. No politics here, sorry. Okay. But that language wasn't working for me, because how you talk about something and the language you use to talk about it very often determines what you can say and what you cannot say. And it was what I could not say that I wanted to talk about. So I investigated a little bit more with these male norms. And this is why I call them male. I don't mean that men are inherently only capable of talking a certain way and that women cannot talk that way and so forth. This discourse, this objective, detached, impersonal discourse, is only male by association. Let me give you just a bit of history, and then I'll finish off the story of my thesis for you. Kind of in prehistory, you had the division of men's and women's roles that came out mostly because of physical differences and reproductive capacities for the species' survival. Men with their stronger upper bodies would go out and work the fields or hunt. And women, by virtue of not having, some of them, not having as strong as upper bodies, would tend to care for the children or do more of the gathering. And that just grew out of that difference, that physical difference. As societies became more agrarian and then more stable, they did not have to constantly be running about trying to survive. There was still some species survival with women and bearing children because they didn't have the technology, of course, to ensure a high birth rate and survival of babies. But there was more free time. But who got the free time is very significant. It was mostly the men that got the free time. And with that free time, they started developing what I would call culture. Social concepts, religious concepts, political, economic. And so as they developed those values and assumptions, they based it on their experiences. While women were still taking care of the children, and they developed that separation of two spheres, a public sphere where the men were and a private sphere where the women were. Now, to me, those are gender constructs. And there can always be a big debate about difference between sex and gender constructs, but I'm going to call them gender constructs. That is, they were not really conscious, but they weren't biologically tied to inherent abilities. Okay. As these norms started developing that the men created from their realm, the institution of patriarchy kind of got set. And then to maintain that institution, that is when those in charge of society began to deliberately use laws and myths to reinforce the status quo. And the people who did that were men, and so did women, so I don't want to say that women were only victims. But let me just sum this up in one sentence. Who defines the norms is often determined by who holds the social, political, and economic and religious power. So if, assuming that men are in this public sphere where they have shaped all of these norms, then their experiences become the ones that are valued. And so to be successful in that norm, you have to use the way their language, their discourse, that impersonal way that they've been approaching things. Why it's impersonal has a lot to do with capitalism, for example. To be involved in capitalism means to objectify other people so that you can beat them out or make more money than they do and so forth. So there needs to be some sense of objectivity. Women, on the other hand, have primarily stayed at home, and they've dealt on a very personal level with their children, with their spouses, with their other friends, and so they've developed a different discourse that suits the realm that they are accustomed to. It's not, I believe, that they are inherently better at it, they just had more practice at it. So what has happened is that women have developed a sense of self, and this is what my thesis came to be about. Women develop a sense of self by identifying with others and internalizing others' perspectives and feelings, and so that another's reality becomes, for example, my own reality. This is called constructed knowing, and it means the knower is part of the known. Ideas are discussed and analyzed in terms of personal experiences and feelings, rather than as you think of a traditional scientific approach where it's me and then there's it. It's separated from myself, and it doesn't really have anything to do with myself. It exists out there apart from me. Women, the way they know things in life, it's very much interrelated. It's a dialectic between feeling and thinking, between speaking and listening, intellect and intuition. And the goal ultimately of women's way of knowing is not proof, but just understanding. Now, the metaphor and means for this constructed knowing is gossip. Now, I finally got to the point here. Let me just define gossip briefly in terms of what I talked about in my thesis. Gossip is an exchange of experiences, whether it's someone else's experiences or your own. I don't want you to think of it in the negative sense of backbiting, although it can be that. But positive gossip is a way of sharing friends' experiences, your experiences, where the talkers grow to understand their lives through understanding that of other people's lives that they know. And yes, the language is personal and chatty, And it might seem childish to many in the academic or the business world, but that was a language that I needed for my thesis because it's what allowed me to express what I felt when I read the historians dismiss The Handmaid's Tale. So I went ahead and used that language in my thesis, and it made me very nervous because I wasn't sure how it was going to be received. Would my thesis committee, would they do what they did to The Handmaid? Would they do what they did to my mom? Now, I have to admit that I did carefully select my thesis committee to make sure it was kind of loaded with people I somewhat trusted. But still, I mean, they had to follow the institution's expectations about what a thesis was and what a thesis defense was supposed to be. So I was quite nervous. Let me just tell you a couple of things about The Handmaid's Tale and my mom, and then I'll finish my thesis defense here. Not that I'm defending it, but, you know. Although I feel like sometimes I am. So, based on this idea of gossip and the difference between proving something and the language you use to prove something and understanding something and the language you use to understand something, I came to understand that the historians had dismissed The Handmaid's Tale because it lacked that tangible, separate, so-called objective proof. They kind of knew her age and a little bit about how she looked in a generic sense and a little bit about her residence. But that's it. Her whole story was experiences and feelings and thoughts. And since the historian's goal was proof, they couldn't make sense of it when all she was asking for was understanding. Same thing with my mom. I think she was asking, although subconsciously, for understanding and wasn't necessarily setting out to prove anything. And so I took the same approach with my thesis. As I went in for my defense, I guess there are about 5 people on my defense committee, which is actually quite a large number compared to the norm. The first thing I had to do was go in, and the people in there had to decide who was going to be the chair of the defense. And so for them, and then they had to decide who was going to go first to ask me these grilling questions that I dreaded. So I had to leave the room and wait for them to decide, usually a 2 or 3 minute process. Well, 5 or 10 minutes had passed, and I was getting very nervous. This is it. I don't want to spend another 2 years of my life writing a thesis. I was almost devastated. I just knew they were going to say, this is not acceptable. So my thesis chair, actually the professor who helped me and guided me in writing this, came back out and put his arm around me and had what I thought was a very sad look on his face. But he always looks sad, so it's kind of hard to tell. And he says, I don't really know how to tell you this, and started walking me back into the room. And he said, we've decided to pass you before your defense, and we're just going to talk about it. And I was taken aback. I thought, they got it. They got the message. They then took the responsibility, the kind of the handoff of what I had given them. And it became then a matter of just understanding and not proof. And the way I had done it, the language I had actually used in my thesis, which I know I didn't stress, but that I used, was that personal, chatty, I-to-you discourse rather than an it-to-it discourse. Thanks. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me add, I did bring copies of the bibliography for my thesis. There are several copies if you're at all interested to pick that up when this is over.
Ships at a distance have every man's wish on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forever on the horizon, never out of sight, never landing, until the watcher turns his eyes away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men. Now, women forget those things they don't want to remember and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. Then they act and do things accordingly. So the beginning of this was a woman, and she had come back from burying the dead. Not the dead of the sick and ailing with friends at pillow and feet. She had come back from the sodden and the bloated, the sudden dead, their eyes flung wide open in judgment. Many of you will recognize these words as the opening paragraphs of Zora Neale Hurston's novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. The novel structure is patterned after the classical Kunstroman, which is a variation of the traditional Bildungsroman, both of which are products of a phallocentric worldview that characterizes man in epic proportions as he embarks on the grand design of his heroic journey. The man may slay dragons or devils, but he always leaves the domestic world and domestic women behind, although he may encounter a princess or two.
However, in Hurston's novel, domesticity is central to the development of the female hero, Janie. It is through her work and her marriages that Janie finally realizes her gift as a storyteller. Janie returns home, like the epic hero after his journey, to relate what she has learned about the world after plowing the fields, stirring up beans, sleeping with husbands, and burying the dead. Perhaps the difference between Janie and the traditional male hero is that Janie rolls up her sleeves and buries her own dead. The male hero shoots his arrows, leaving the fallen bodies for others to deal with as he climbs back on his white horse and rides into the sunset. But in Hurston's novel, it is the hero herself who buries the dead. Hurston told the story of Janie long before women's voices were respected. These stories were told over fences, on back porches, and in the aisles of the corner market. But women's conversation has often been labeled as chatter or gossip. Do you remember the song from The Music Man that portrays women as clucking hens? In my childhood, my mother and her friend Wanda often talked to one another through their facing kitchen windows. In the summertime, they sat on the lawn, and I remember that if my mother stayed out too long and did not get dinner ready on time, my father was quick to say something like, "Out there gossiping again with the neighbors?" Gossip is a pejorative term, and one which all my life I have heard used to describe the way women talk to one another. It is a label rarely pinned on men, even when they are actually doing it. My point in bringing this up is to show how women's stories have been minimized and even ridiculed. It is only recently that the stories women have always told, the stories that illuminate their lives, have gained respect. I have noticed this because I am an avid reader of contemporary fiction. It is astonishing how many books deal with the theme of healing through storytelling. Certainly, Janie's resolution comes with the telling of her own story. Hurston describes Janie as being full of that oldest human longing, self-revelation. Perhaps what Hurston meant in the opening paragraphs of her novel is that women tell stories which reveal themselves as they really are, and that men tell stories which reveal what they would like to be. Another heroine, Ava Luna, in Isabel Allende's book, Ava Luna, also discovers that telling stories not only helps her to survive, but gives her power. Like Scheherazade in Tales of the Arabian Nights, Ava weaves stories that mesmerize her listeners and cause them to be merciful towards her. Her stories are mostly true. Ava has lived a fantastic but sad life. The way she blends together these tragic stories is like sprinkling fairy dust on an otherwise dull world. She does not hide the truth, but she does make it luminous. In Ursula Hege's wonderful novel, Stones from the River, the hero is Trudy Montag, a dwarf growing up in Germany during World War II. Because she is a person who is ridiculed and even humiliated, she learns to use stories for revenge. People in the small German town where she lives tell Trudy their stories. Gradually, Trudy leaks the more lurid and damaging details into the community. In the beginning, Trudy uses these stories to hurt and not to understand people. But as the novel progresses, it does not take long before the stories begin to transform Trudy, and she finds that the purpose of her stories had changed. She spun them to discover their meaning. In the telling, she found you reached a point where you could not go back, where the stories had changed, where, as the story changed, it transformed you too. She spun them to discover their meaning. What mattered was to let each story flow through you. It was becoming impossible to revert to her old reasons for telling stories, to get even, to prod, or to soothe. Later, in the last pages of the novel, Trudy realizes another thing that these stories have done to her. In sorting it out, she felt deep compassion for him and everyone who inhabited her story. For me, this description of story is a description of love. We gather, listen, and absorb one another's stories. We merge other stories with our own, and the result, of course, is that we are willing to change. We are able to mourn with those that mourn and comfort those who stand in need of comfort. Hege also writes that Trudy's story contains magic and truth, corruption and redemption, sadness and joy, love and betrayal. All these elements are found not just in stories of the triumphant hero fighting his or her way to self-revelation, but in our everyday lives. Nor do we have to leave our neighborhoods to hear stories which reveal such things to us. We don't have to sail the Congo, hike Mount Everest, or escape the labyrinth. While men have been off fighting their battles, women have been learning about redemption in their own backyards. Those conversations over the backyard fence are not trivial gossip. Instead, they are the stories which bind us together,
the stories which allow us to know that we are not alone. But in order to create these bonds, it is important to tell the truth in our stories. By truth, I do not mean accuracy. I mean that we as women have tended to be more self-revealing in our discourse, partly because we do not have as much at stake as the men whose power and position rest on image. Because of this, women have the ability to heal and be healed through story. As we share our weaknesses, our struggles, and our failures, we become like Trudy Montag. We learn love and compassion. I have noticed an interesting phenomenon among Mormon women. We tend to be very good at telling the stories our community wants to hear. In the early church, many women defended polygamy publicly with passion and fervor, only to write of their dissatisfaction and even of their pain in the pages of their journals. Recently, when I attended the BYU Women's Conference, I went to a session called something like When One Door Closes, Another Opens. Another woman's initial presentation on that panel was a faith-promoting story about how the death of one of her babies led to the conversion of a family they were fellowshipping. But once these women began to depart from their prepared remarks in the question and answer session, the truth of their lives became more apparent. Once they began interacting with the women in the room on a more personal level, they were willing to reveal the cracks in their carefully plotted experiences. They were willing to share their pain, their anger, and their confusion. But I do not use this example in order to be critical. I share it because it is so typical of our community. We are under a great deal of pressure to preserve a certain image. My own Utah Valley Mormon neighborhood is an example. Beneath the surface of beautiful homes, well-scrubbed children, successful doctors, lawyers, and stockbrokers are bad marriages, children on drugs, controlling parents, adults who were sexually abused as children, and much more that I'm sure I don't even know about. But why talk about these things? Is there any value in being honest about our lives, both the good and the bad? Many people I know don't see the point of talking about their problems and struggles. After all, why dwell upon the negative? Well, I don't necessarily think we should dwell on the negative. I think it would be wrong to see life as all darkness and hopelessness, just as it would be wrong to portray life as nothing but sweetness and light. But in telling the truth, I think we find a balance. Look at good novels like Peggy Stone's From the River. In it there is tragedy, sadness, and evil, but there is also hope, redemption, and joy. For me, life is like that, and I think it is important to be honest about both the good and the bad. When I first got married and had children, I hated staying home all day. I felt stagnant, stupid, and bored. But these were thoughts I kept to myself. If only I was a better person, if only I read the scriptures more, if only I did this or that. After all, I had been taught that being a wife and a mother was supposed to be fulfilling and joyful. When I didn't feel those things, I was horrified with myself. Years later, however, after I moved to Utah, I was walking home from my neighborhood book group with one of the women. I don't remember what we were talking about, but at one point she said that she remembered how depressed she was after her first baby was born. It was awful, she said. I hated that time in my life. I felt lonely and bored. It was refreshing and liberating to have someone tell the truth of her experience. No longer did I feel like such an aberration. Telling the truth in our stories creates an intimacy between us. After that conversation with my friend, I felt like I could trust her, and I loved her for being so honest. Of course, truth is not an absolute, immovable thing. Truth is relative to our interpretations, perceptions, and memories. But I believe if we tell the truth of our experience as we ourselves perceive it, we will find it healing and liberating. If we tell the truth in our own stories and allow others to tell the truth in theirs, we will be transformed like Trudy Montag. I think the reason, perhaps, that women's conversations have been called gossip is because so-called gossip does often strip away the veneer and the polish of the images we want to display publicly. Gossip reveals the bad marriages, the failures, the struggles, and gossip is bad if we talk about these things as if we are immune to them. Gossip is bad if we set ourselves up as the one who has it all together while the people we gossip about are failures. Gossip is bad if we use it to disgrace people. The way we tell our stories is important. We can tie them into neat little packages where good is always rewarded, where tragedy ends up being all for the best, where the system that is in place always works and is always benevolent. Or we can tell the truth about our lives as we see it and end up doing one of the most subversive and powerful things a woman or anyone else outside of the power structure can do. This is one of the reasons storytelling figures so prominently in the novels that I have mentioned. Ava Luna lives under a repressive, militaristic regime. Later in the novel, Ava decides to acknowledge her gift of telling stories. During most of her childhood, these stories, though sometimes based on truth, are full of the fantastic. Finally, Ava begins telling the stories that would not otherwise be told. The story of the guerrilla fighters who in the end are defeated. Since it is the victors who create and disseminate the official stories, Ava's chronicle of the defeated guerrillas is particularly important. This telling of stories that might not otherwise be heard is also a prominent theme in Stones from the River. At the end of the novel, Trudy discovers the healing power in stories as she decides what she can do for her friend George, who has died. What she could offer George was far more than what had happened. A certain sequence that would lead him to the core of the story, a story that would hold an entire world. It had to do with what to tell first, though it hadn't happened first, and what to end the story with. It had to do with what to enhance, and what to relinquish, and what to embrace. In my own life, I have struggled with this issue. Like Trudy, I have a story to tell about someone who has died. 17 months ago, my husband Bryant died of cancer. The disease was cruel, and Bryant fought death with every shred of will and strength he possessed. But despite blessings, prayers, and hopes for miracles, he died. I have been almost militant in my insistence that people recognize the tragedy of Bryant's death, because it was tragic. We have 5 sons, and he wanted to help raise them. Bryant was a great dad. He never accepted his death, although at one point he did write in his journal, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." There was no closure in Bryant's death because he would never accept the fact of it. Instead, it seemed violent rather than peaceful, as if Bryant was torn from mortality. I will never believe that Bryant died because he had some greater mission to fulfill on the other side, as some believe. I cannot believe that his death was for the best. Bryant himself was offended by these justifications for his suffering. Both of us refuse, and I still refuse, to fit the story of his death into a Mormon worldview that contends death is never a tragedy if you have enough faith. If we try and fit stories into a prescribed mold, how can we ever learn from and be transformed by them or feel the pain from them, which is actually the transforming force? Trudy uses the metaphor of raking through soil to learn how to tell the story in a way which will have meaning. As Trudy creates patterns in the dirt, she sifts through the clumps and discards the debris. The final design wouldn't happen all at once. There would be the rearrangement of it all, a fine combing through. There would be perseverance and reverence for the task. There would be the assurance that, indeed, a design would emerge. I am still looking for the design in my own story. Like Trudy, I am sifting through the clumps. But unlike Janie, I have not come back yet from burying the dead. I am still there with a shovel in my hands, asking people to see that my hands are dirt-stained and calloused. But as I tell my story, I hope for understanding and for meaning. And like Janie, that I might find the answer is not in any resolution necessarily, but perhaps in the telling itself. Thank you.